Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Allows us to stay vigilant against their onslaught. And if you give this month, you'll receive access to the Cultural Institute video, When Your Faith is Illegal, by Frank Harbor on AFA Stream as our thanks. You can make your gift today at afaaction.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Thursday, May 15th, and President Trump in Qatar announces the largest ever contract with Boeing. This coming from Fox Business. The White House said he signed an agreement with Qatar to generate an economic exchange worth at least $1.2 trillion. That figure includes economic deals totaling more than $250 billion between the U.S. and Qatar. The White House said that Boeing and GE Aerospace landed a deal with Qatar Airways worth $96 billion to acquire up to 210 Boeing 787 Dreamliners and 777X aircraft, which are powered by GE Aerospace engines. This marks the largest ever order for Boeing's wide-body aircraft, as well as the largest ever 747 order. This seems to be a little bit interesting coming in the news with everything else going on in the airline industry. But meanwhile, a poll with all of this going on and Trump securing these massive deals and Republicans being, you know, very Trump is the art of the deal and going full speed ahead. A poll from the Associated Press indicates that Democrats are deeply pessimistic about the future of their party. And I'm thinking, wow, shocker. They're deeply pessimistic. So 6 months after Donald Trump's presidential victory, Democrats remain deeply pessimistic about the future of their party. A new poll conducted earlier this month by the Associated Press Center for Public Affairs Research found that only one third of Democrats are very optimistic or even somewhat optimistic about their party's future. That's sharply down from July 2024, when about 6 in 10 Democrats said they had a positive outlook. I wonder what happened around July 2024. Like, anybody know that, you know, what took a nosedive at that point in time? Well, let's welcome in Steve Dace, our good friend, who is a host and author over at The Blaze. And Steve, this also indicates, though, that meanwhile, Republicans are slightly more optimistic about the future of the GOP than they were last year. Only slightly. That's a little interesting. But I think this poll is laughable at best, because it's absolutely true. The Democrats have no reason to be optimistic about the future of their party.
I can give them one reason. Republicans in Congress. That's right. If I were them and I looked at my leadership, my bench, and you're seeing polls that Jasmine Crockett and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are their most recognizable figures. And we're talking about, you know, variations of the Kamala Harris theme. I can see why they feel that way. And, you know, what we have seen really for a generation or two now on the Democratic side is that where they have wanted to take the country really since the counterculture remade the modern Democratic Party. And the modern Democratic Party has been remade from a pro-labor, pro-worker party, left of center economically, fairly centrist overall on patriotism and values. That was the Democratic Party prior to the Summer of Love. And what's been happening really ever since in the boomer era is it's been, you know, little by little, incrementally, it's been remade over from a liberal party to a leftist one, from a party, you know, that said, hey, government should let God, you know, let you do things that God says are stupid and immoral, to government like the story you guys just had in your news update before I came on about the state of Colorado's ongoing jihad against Christianity in all of its forms. Now government must compel you to do these things. And so without a charismatic leader, in the case of a Barack Obama or a Bill Clinton, someone who is inherently likable to the average normie out there, without that person as a package, as the front for what they're selling to the American people, it has just not been bought. And you even look at the Obama years, Jenna. I mean, he got walloped in two midterm elections when he was not on the ballot, both in 2010 and also in 2014. So this has been a reoccurring pattern for them. And right now what they lack is that kind of a leader, the person that will make, you know, to use their phrase, and a phrase that Tim Walz used recently, a permission structure, someone whose personality is engaging and charismatic enough that it's a permission structure for Americans to essentially become extras in a remake of Reds. All right. And they don't have that right now. And I don't even know that person's even on the immediate horizon. But as for this next midterm election, I bring glad tidings of great joy to those pessimistic Democrats. This Republican Congress is doing absolutely everything it could possibly do to nuke itself. And it is doing everything it could possibly do to make Donald Trump a lame duck president, essentially the first Wednesday of next November. So this is why you're also seeing Republicans are only slightly more optimistic than they were this time last summer, because you guys they're seeing the same thing that I am seeing as well. And you're essentially seeing the president leave the country whenever he can, act unilaterally whenever he can, because, you know, in sports, a lot of times in this era, they sell these sweatshirts, your team against the world. It's really the Trump administration against the world. Right? And then there really is no wingman. I mean, Maverick's out there without Iceman. Okay, there's no wingman. There's nothing happening at the U.S. Congress whatsoever. They can't even bring themselves to work 5 days a week. The biggest argument they've had is who gets to vote and from when and from where. The only thing we're missing is Pedro telling us, I will make all of your dreams come true, because this stuff is high school.
So well said. And actually, I was talking with a friend the other day about how politics and everything that goes on in campaigning and in the political world is really just high school all over again, except that I was homeschooled and didn't have to go through that the first time. So it's like I'm experiencing that for the first time. But Steve, I think that you bring a sobering moment back to the GOP, because as the Democrats are on their heels in the most obvious way, because they don't have a spokesperson, they don't have a cohesive message, they don't have anything to run on except hating Trump, which really has not worked for them. It's spectacularly failed. The only thing that the GOP is not doing is getting it together, because Congress, and I had several members of Congress on the show yesterday and talking about the big, beautiful bill and what exactly is going on. Why aren't you guys codifying anything? And the conference altogether is just not coordinated. And so Representative Marlon Stutzman, who is one of my guests, was saying even defunding Planned Parenthood, which should be a priority, and I agree with him, he said, you know, that can't even be a standalone bill at the moment, because probably at least six or seven Republicans, along with a GOP conference in the House, would vote it down. I mean, that's the state of the GOP right now, and that's frankly disgusting.
It is. And one of the things we talk a lot in my circles about privately and publicly is how much clout and whether or not the president, how much could he really put his thumb on the scale with this Republican Congress? And I cannot excuse too many of the president's primary endorsements. Listen, for every Ron DeSantis, which we probably never would have gotten as governor of Florida without Trump's endorsement in his first race, for every one of those, there's at least three or four endorsements that Trump has made in GOP primaries that are just, you know, they're self-cannibalizing, particularly with his D.C. endorsement. So I can't apply what I'm about to say to that. I think that's a separate matter. And you know, one day, on my list of questions to ask Jesus, one day I'm going to ask, why did Trump endorse so many of these terrible people in primaries, where that's where he had the clout, unquestionably, to just, you know, rid us of many of these people and rid himself of that. But in terms of what goes on in D.C., I think a dynamic that a lot of people don't understand. Right now, there's about three times more people that are members of this Bill Kristol Main Street Caucus than the Freedom Caucus. It's at least three times, might even be four times more members. And I think people don't understand the environment and the culture in D.C. So if Trump were to go on Truth Social and call out you call out every single one, including my U.S. Senator, Charles Grassley, who yesterday or 2 days ago voted against codifying the DOGE cuts, or came out as a coalition against codifying the DOGE cuts, even just minimal cuts of waste, fraud, and abuse, the kind of stuff that people like you and I were saying in January, hey, these are nice tokens and talking points, but this isn't going to put a dent in the debt. You can't get 26 Republican senators and members of Congress to even to agree to that. Okay, so let's say Trump decided when he got back here from Qatar, he's going to the mattresses against these. Many of these people are so entrenched that they're so protected by the GOP primary voter as incumbents that are just used to voting for the same swine. The dog returns to its own vomit over and over again. Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, Charles Grassley in my state. I mean, we have moved our state precipitously to the red in ways I couldn't even have been optimistic about when we started this 15 years ago, Jenna. And we still have not been able to penetrate the federal election primary voter here in Iowa. We can't even do it here, right? So just the same people over and over again, no matter what, over and over again. Okay, let's say he went after those folks. They're so entrenched, number one. I don't know how much immediate pressure would be felt. But if they did start to feel it, you know what they do? Just retire. I think people don't understand all the things that they enjoy under the table now, side pieces, grift. They just get it all legally. I mean, there are law firms and lobbyist firms just all throughout K Street that would just gladly welcome in. Hey, they would get a helmet sticker. They'd get their version of a well done, good and faithful servant. You stood in the gap for the special interests. And I think your home state of Florida, where you live now, is an excellent example of this. What's going on in your state right now is a bunch of Republicans who never wanted to do the stuff we wanted them to do, that Ron DeSantis finally did. They're trying to kamikaze your entire state because they really got into this, most of them did, to be somebody and not do something. And the somebody they wanted to be was the sugar lobby's biggest pimp, the icky sticky, the chronic wacky tobacco's biggest prostitute. That's what they really wanted to do. And so now the minute that they thought because he lost, a primary to Trump, that he was politically weakened, he's about to be term limited out. They essentially tried to kamikaze, and they're doing it right now in real time, kamikaze everything. And so the DeSantis people respond by, well, maybe we'll just run Casey for governor to kind of leverage them. So maybe we won't be term limited. We'll find a workaround here and we'll stick around. Their response was to double, triple down, essentially turn your 2025 state legislative session, what makes what's happening in Congress right now look like a leadership forum. This is just beyond stupidity, what's going on there, except your legislature is who most of the Republican Party is. And that's who most of the Republican primary voter has allowed to get entrenched there for decades. And we're in a position now where these people are almost unleverageable. I mean, John Cornyn is in the middle of a primary right now that he is losing. I mean, there hasn't been a poll that has shown him ahead of Ken Paxton yet. The last one showed him up down by 16 points. And this is even before Trump gets involved in that primary. And you would think right now he would be doing everything he could in order to grandstand to save his seat. All he's done is he posted a video of him reading Art of the Deal, the book, and how he thought it was a great read. Meanwhile, he went up there and nuked Ed Martin. Why? Because whatever special interest John Cornyn gets his supply of grift and side pieces from, it's just going to reward him for the continued hustle that he has done on their behalf. And so there's both parties right now, they're chickens, as Barack Obama, his infamous anti-American pastor, once said, are coming home to roost. And what you're seeing right now is Democrats, they have moved so far left, they cannot sell their agenda to the American people anymore unless there's a charismatic leader that can use car salesman them. So they're stuck in that corner. And on the Republican side, the Republican primary, that's what the boomer Democrat did. And on the Republican side, the boomer Republican primary voter has so boxed in our side now that we are just surrounded by Quislings and grifters and con artists to the point that, I mean, there's just absolute gridlock and rigor mortis there, because those handful of Republicans you talked about, they'll just retire. Who knows, in each state's individual process of replacing them in various elections and things of that nature, and they could just grind this thing to a halt. We can't leverage them because they're protected by special interests. So, yeah, this is why nothing good gets done unless Donald Trump and his administration unilaterally does it.
And so, Steve, then that begs the question, what happens post-Trump to the GOP, to America, to all of these wins? Are we just saying, all right, the next 3.5 years will be great, and then after that, you know, it's total apocalypse for America?
What's going to happen is, if this administration is successful, there's really no point to having a 2028 presidential primary, all right, because the crown prince is already in place, and it's J.D. Vance. And I think you can see from Vance's, you know, he'd be the first millennial presidential nominee. And I think you can see just from how he engages directly, even as vice president of the United States, on social media, I think he's got way more of an appetite for destruction than Trump when it comes to this part of it, when it comes to the domestic politics side of it and calling out BS and getting after people in his own party. I think generations, box themselves in layers and then, free themselves in layers. The first thing, Trump is the first layer. And what Trump is trying to free us from is the global paradigm, the globalist paradigm. And he's in the process of doing this as we speak, all right, to try to get America back on the path of being independent and a sovereign country again. No one man's going to undo 50 years of damage, rot, gut, and complacency in one term or even two. So he's the first layer of this. You know, that's the problem we have with Reagan, is Reagan's first layer was, we have to win the Cold War. He accomplished that. The problem is the Republican leadership that came after him never took that fight beyond that. And so we just remain kind of stillborn. And weren't the 80s great? And let's just run on the same slogans of the 80s. And who was closest to Reagan when he was doing that stuff in the 80s? We were just kind of stillborn and stuck there for decades until Trump came along. So what you have now is the obvious heir apparent for Reagan. Bush did not share many of Reagan's actual ideals beyond just hatred of communism. And so in this case, you have JD, who's clearly a chip off the old block ideologically, and is anxious, I think would be way more willing to then say, hey, we've accomplished this first goal. Now we've got to take out the trash here in our own neighborhood. All right. So that's what happens if the Trump administration is successful. I think what you don't want to contemplate is what happens if it's not successful. And if it's not successful, then I think you're at this point, you're probably better off finding whatever Republican you hate the most, making them your nominee in 28 to take the L, because we're going to take one and it's going to be bad and it won't matter who they nominate over there. OK, and so this is why I think Trump and his team knows this. And this is why they've been so aggressive out of the gate. I think this is why they continue to be as aggressive as they are. I think this is why they continue to take as much initiative as they do, because I think they realize here that they've got a window to truly reset things. And if they don't take full advantage of it, and some of the, you know, silliness of the first term, you know, let's have the first fight out of the gate be whether or not more people showed up at my inauguration than Barack Obama, and let's introduce the country to Omarosa and Anthony Scaramucci. I think this is just a way more buttoned-down professional outfit. The president clearly is way more prepared to govern than he was the first time around. And I think they agree with much of the analysis I'm giving you, which is why you see them as bold and as brash as they are.
Well said. And I think you're absolutely right that we're seeing this in Florida in real time. After 8 years of wins by an excellent governor, then you have all of these very selfish people coming into the House and just absolutely trying to destroy it through the legislature. And we're seeing that on the congressional level as well. And so this is why the GOP needs to get it together and actually become the party of conservatism instead of the party of special interests. But we'll continue to talk about this more. And I always appreciate Steve's comments. So right on and so sobering. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, in an HHS update, RFK Jr. has pledged to hold Johnson & Johnson accountable for what he describes as a, quote, pattern of corporate misconduct. This coming from a couple of reports that have just surfaced around social media. In 2021, as you'll recall, Johnson & Johnson actually recalled 5 aerosol sunscreen products after laboratory testing detected benzene, a known carcinogen, in the products. RFK has claimed, according to reports, that Johnson & Johnson continue to generate significant revenue from cancer treatment, which is used to treat blood cancers that were linked to benzene exposure. He highlights this as an example of corporate hypocrisy, where the company profits from both causing and then treating cancer. So where are we at with the whole MAHA movement? Let's welcome in Raw Egg Nationalist, Charles Cornishdale, who goes by Raw Egg Nationalist on social media, has a great book and comments on all things health related. So where are we at with making America healthy again?
It's great to be back, Jenna. It's great to be back. So yeah, I mean, I think that we're starting to make some significant progress. RFK Jr. has announced various different measures to be brought in. We've got synthetic food dyes being banned. Now, these are dyes like Red 3 and Red 40. They've been linked to all sorts of unpleasant health conditions, chronic health conditions, things like ADHD, autism, diabetes. And they're ubiquitous in processed food, and processed food increasingly makes up the majority of the average American's diet. So there are very clear efforts already taking place to clean up the food supply. We've also got this big investigation into the causes of autism, which we talked about, actually, I think the last time I came on the show. That's been generating a lot of controversy. It's caused a real stir. But I think, again, it's a move in the right direction. It's a signal that RFK is interested in addressing the root causes of chronic health rather than simply devising new ad hoc treatments with Big Pharma to make more money for Big Pharma and leaving the underlying problems unaddressed. So I think it's very clear already that what we're seeing is a fundamental reorientation. You know, we've had some big firings too. You know, getting rid of kind of useless staff and cutting down on waste. So there are all sorts of things going on, Jenna. We've had the announcement also of an investigation into baby formula, which I think is a big thing too. So baby formula, I think, is best thought of actually as baby's first processed food. So, you know, all of the terrible ingredients that you find in processed food that are having all of these dreadful chronic health effects, or a link to chronic health effects in, you know, numerous scientific studies, they're all in baby food as well. And, you know, we've seen a substitution of baby formula for breast milk in recent decades, certainly in the last sort of 60, 70 years. And it's contributed definitely to the chronic health crisis. We've also got, this is another thing, actually, the last thing that I'll mention. We've also seen that actually Jay Bhattacharya has talked about removing Big Pharma representatives from the FDA's advisory boards. Now, that's a very good thing too, because that's an attempt, the beginning of an attempt to reestablish the independence of the FDA from the industries that it regulates. Now, the FDA and the USDA and all of these different big departments, you know, they're in bed and have been in bed with industry for decades, and we need to decouple them, the regulators, from the industries they're regulating, so that we can actually be confident that these industries are being regulated in an objective, fair way that benefits the American public and not the corporation's bottom line.
Yeah, and I think all of that makes sense as a strategy and as something that will actually benefit the American people. And contrasting this to a lot of the policies, I think that Americans overall, and certainly the MAGA base, have been very frustrated that Congress is refusing, at least at this juncture, to be as swift to codify as Trump is to issue executive orders. A lot of this is happening a bit unilaterally from HHS in terms of setting policy. But how much will these big corporations, whose entire existence is reliant on a lot of these chemicals, these other things that are very unhealthy, and all of these things that have been going on since, you know, the 50s and 60s, how much of this are they going to push back on if it's just a matter of a waiting game until Kennedy is no longer in HHS and we don't necessarily have the same policy?
Yeah, this is the question. I mean, there are some decent early indications. So with the banning of synthetic dyes, then actually HHS and the FDA have been saying, look, we want to do this voluntarily with corporations. And the corporations have said, yes, we'll replace these synthetic dyes with natural alternatives. The FDA is already in the process of approving various different natural alternatives to things like Red 3 and Red 40. And the corporations are saying, yeah, we're gonna replace these synthetic dyes in our products, which obviously, begs the question, why didn't you do it before? If you could make these products with natural dyes, why didn't you? Anyway, the big issue is, you know, what is going to happen in 4 years' time or 8 years' time? I mean, I've maintained from the start that Make America Healthy Again needs to be basically a generational agenda. You know, it's taken a century really to make Americans as unhealthy as they are today. And it's going to take years, multiple administrations, in order to undo the damage that has been done. And so I think already RFK and the Trump administration more broadly, they need to be thinking about setting a generational agenda. They need to be thinking about how they can ensure that the good that is done in these 4 years isn't undone straight away. Because yes, as you say, these corporations could just play a waiting game. They could just play for time and stall, and then 4 years is up and there's a different administration and suddenly Make America Healthy Again isn't so much on the agenda and it's all just forgotten. And that would be a big shame.
Yeah. And so, of course, I'm speaking with Raw Egg Nationalist, who you can follow on X, and he is an author and writes prolifically on all of these health topics. This begs the question, then, is this really a bipartisan issue? I mean, it should be. It should be something that is objectively not political, the health and well-being of the constituency of a country and our food supply, all of these things. But do the Democrats, if they are ever to get in power again, and we'll see that as early as the midterms next year, whether they take back the House or the Senate in terms of a majority, but even potentially the White House in another 3.5 years, where is their current Biden? I mean, absent just the political hostility toward Kennedy himself and obviously Trump, as far as the movement itself goes, do Democrats have any sort of buy-in to make America healthy?
I think that the political hostility towards RFK Jr. actually is very important, because I think it's really, you know, he is a turncoat to Democrats. And so it's personal in that regard. And I think for a lot of them, then they simply won't countenance the idea of getting on board with the Make America Healthy Again agenda, because it's Kennedy and because he is historically a Democrat. He's from a great Democrat family, Democrat presidents. You know, he was denounced by his own family during the presidential campaign. So that is a big part of it. That's really clouding the judgment, I think, of Democrats, blinding them to the essentially nonpartisan nature of the health of the nation. And certainly, I mean, during the presidential campaign, then there was no alternative. There was no Democrat answer to the Make America Healthy Again agenda. It was just totally a Trump Kennedy platform. And so, during RFK's confirmation, then Bernie Sanders did say to him, look, I agree with the notion of making America healthy again, Mr. Kennedy, but I don't agree with your methods. I think that what we need to be doing is we need to be prescribing people Ozempic. You know, we need to be giving all the overweight and obese people Ozempic, and we need to be lowering drug charges. Well, actually, I mean, Trump has done something, you know, really quite amazing, actually, to reduce the cost of drugs recently with his executive order in the last few days. I think it was at the weekend, you know, saying that he would reduce drug costs by up to 80%. I don't think that the Democrats buy in to Kennedy's methods fundamentally. This is I could see there being a health agenda on the left, but I think that the methods fundamentally would be basically just about increasing people's access to drugs rather than at a reasonable price or even at, you know, taxpayer cost, rather than actually getting to the bottom of ill health, rather than addressing the root causes of ill health. I mean, one of the things, you know, that the left generally is, obviously they're collectivists. They don't really believe in individual responsibility. So any notion that actually individuals might have a part to play in their own health, then they deny more and more. And you know, you hear them say vehemently, oh, it's fascism. It's fascism to say that people should be responsible for their own lives. You know, it's right-wing extremism. So it's a hugely polarized issue. It really is. And I don't actually, from the left, I don't see sense breaking through the kind of clouds of the kind of politicization. So as far as I can see, then no, I don't think it's going to be a nonpartisan issue anytime soon, which is a big shame because, like you say, it really should be.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating to see how the media then morphs this into, you know, freedom essentially and self-governance and choosing for ourselves. That's somehow right-wing extremism. It's like, well, then all of the founders were right-wing extremists, which actually is basically what they're claiming with trying to rewrite America's founding and the Constitution, calling all of them, you know, racist and all of that. They would love to categorize everyone like that. But the bottom line here is that HHS and Kennedy really need to make a lot of headway in the next 3.5 years so that there is a really good carving out of this kind of strategy before the 2028 presidential election, regardless of which party is in power at that point. I mean, these are things that are central to the health and genuinely safety of Americans. And like you said, I mean, I don't think that the goal and the emphasis should be to get lower drug prices and just have so many drugs accessible to Americans. It should be finding the root cause and actually solving some of these problems. But it'll be interesting to see how far we get in the next 3.5 years. And of course, always appreciate the updates from Raw Egg Nationalist. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network Clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Let's turn to a couple of legal topics now. First, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments today on a long simmering issue. This coming from NBC News. Birthright citizenship dispute at the Supreme Court has broad implications for Trump's agenda. So individual federal judges who block policies nationwide, these nationwide injunctions, is taking center stage today in oral arguments. And so the court is not actually looking at the birthright citizenship issue specifically. Instead, it will focus on the power of judges to block presidential policies across the country. And the question for now is focusing only on whether lower court judges had the authority to block these executive policies nationwide, as three different district court judges did in three different cases. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is the founder of the Lawfare Project. And Gerard, I kind of have hope that the current majority of the Supreme Court is taking more of a judicial restraint tack here by addressing what I think is initially the threshold question here before they even get into the merit of the policy. It's whether or not the judiciary actually has the constitutional power to adjudicate a power that's constitutionally given to the executive. And so I see this as more of a separation of powers issue and maybe, just maybe, restraining the judiciary into their actual Article III authority.
I think you're right in part. I think there is a lot to be said that the Supreme Court will be looking this term at the separation of powers at Article II and Article III and saying what is within the broad purview of the executive and what limits the courts should have in trying to stop what the president is doing when lawsuits are filed. I do tend to think that will come up more in the context of deportations and enforcement of immigration law. I think that when it comes to this 14th Amendment argument, they are looking at this as more of a proper exercise of judicial power. But the question really is whether courts should have the power to issue these nationwide injunctions, whether that's going too far and whether there's a better way to do it. And in looking at the answers, I think the Supreme Court will be guided by past precedent and the previous use of these nationwide injunctions, which have also seen good uses. So it's not going to be an easy question today.
And that's really fascinating. So what can we expect then from the differing arguments? I mean, just from the practical application, which is to if the court allows lower district judges to issue these nationwide injunctions, that would thwart Trump's policy. So I can imagine that the three leftists on the court will be very eager to keep that in place. But where do you anticipate the court, at least in its questioning, is going to go in terms of balancing this issue?
I think in part we'll see questioning on whether the issues being addressed by the lower courts, by the courts that are issuing these injunctions, are core constitutional questions, whether they're the types of questions that the interpretation of the answer will be equally applicable in every state, or whether these cases involve fact-specific situations that don't necessarily have a broader implication across the country. So basically looking at whether the questions being asked in the lower courts are of such importance that they could potentially affect every person in a class of people, or whether these are very fact-specific limits limited to specific cases. In the case of a 14th Amendment argument that's underlying, you know, ending birthright citizenship, I do think the court will see that this is more of a nationwide issue and not fact-specific. That's why I made the distinction before. I think there's a difference in how the courts will go about assessing this for deportation cases versus what they're looking at as a core 14th Amendment question.
So is it possible then that we will get out of this opinion some kind of test or at least requirement that a judge who has this type of opportunity on a fact-specific level in the future will then have to first make a determination of whether there are implications nationwide before then issuing an injunction? And then that determination and however the court opines whether that's a yes or that's a no, then that can then become kind of the fact-specific appellate issue? I mean, are we looking at perhaps some sort of a test out of the Supreme Court?
I think we may see something similar. At the end of the day, when the opinion is actually issued, I think we may see something akin to presidential immunity in the sense that we will get some more language from the Supreme Court clarifying what factors courts should look at when determining whether to impose a nationwide injunction. But as with presidential immunity, I think that it will leave a lot of questions open. So it will not be the end-all answer. But I do see the Supreme Court is looking to categorize what types of cases are ripe for these nationwide injunctions and which ones are better left to be adjudicated individually and stay in the local district or stay in the circuit.
And this is fascinating. I'm speaking with Jared Folletti, who is the founder of the Lawfare Project, on this issue coming before the Supreme Court today, Thursday, and the oral arguments that will happen at the Supreme Court. And do you think that there will be potentially some broader commentary on the issue of judicial ability to adjudicate? I mean, things that are or things that are non-justiciable issues. I mean, like commenting specifically on executive policy, because the American people, by virtue of voting in Donald Trump, have said we want to vest the Trump administration and the president personally, because obviously, as you know, Article 2 vests the authority in a president of the United States, not just his administration and all of those people, but in a president. We have chosen Donald Trump to be that person. And so when he executes policy according to the powers that are given to him by virtue of Article 2. It's not for the Supreme Court to second guess the policy. It's only whether or not he can exercise a power or actually has it in a specific way. So it's a can versus should question. And should, of course, being the policy question, that's the political question doctrine. But will we see, do you think, any of that type of conversation largely trying to at least parse when it comes to the executive, what is fully within the executive purview and confining some of these rogue judges that are just going well beyond their scope? Like, I'm thinking of this Judge Boasberg, who literally told the plane to turn around. It was carrying the Tren de Aragua members, and somehow thought that that he actually had the judicial authority to do that. Are we going to see some of those broader questions at least commented on or potentially resolved in this opinion?
I think they may be commented on, but I don't think that they'll be the crux of today's arguments. I think that, unfortunately, for those of us who'd like more resolution as to, you know, the powers of the presidency that are non-justiciable or that should not bear the level of scrutiny that has been brought to bear, these cases, the 14th Amendment cases, the birthright cases, are not the best vehicle, because here you're looking at the president interpreting a law. You're not looking at a policy decision. You're looking, deportations are a policy decision. You're acting on a law that's been passed and deciding, as Secretary Rubio has done, that certain standards must be met in order to be in this country. That is something that is more of a political question. When you're interpreting the 14th Amendment, that's a legal question. I don't think you're going to get into that distinction today, whether courts are going too far into the political questions. But I do think that we'll start getting that distinction in the parallel cases that will inevitably make their way up to the Supreme Court, which are these deportation cases.
And I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who is the founder of the Lawfare Project. You can follow him at Gerard Folletti on X. And so those oral arguments are going to begin today at 10 a.m. Eastern. You can always listen to them now live if you're interested in this case. And I always am. And so listen to as many of the arguments as I can, which I love that they actually stream it live now. But Gerard, I want to turn to another question and another legal issue. And so this is coming from CNN, that new book, and they're, of course, referring to Jake Tapper's book, that somehow now he's just aghast that Joe Biden was apparently not mentally competent while in office. And he's, you know, utterly shocked because Jake Tapper, of course, had absolutely no idea, like any of us, you know, before now. But so I find the hyperbole just absolutely hilarious from CNN. But new book, Jake Tapper's book, reveals how Biden's inner circle kept the cabinet from him in his final 2 years of the presidency. And so this goes on to say that some members of former President Joe Biden's cabinet did not believe that he could be relied upon to perform at 2 a.m. during an emergency by the final year of his presidency. According to this new book, several secretaries have told the authors of the book that Biden's inner circle grew so small in 2023 and 2024 that even some members of his cabinet weren't included. This raises, I think, a lot of implications, but first, is there any kind of accountability that should be brought to some of these cabinet officials? Because, I mean, I think a lot of people are talking about, you know, the pardons, the voiding potentially of those, you know, a lot of things surrounding Joe Biden. But if some of these staffers and cabinet officials actually knew this and were convinced that Biden was not competent, is any of that potentially criminal in nature?
Well, it raises the question of why the 25th Amendment wasn't invoked. When you have a president who is clearly not competent to serve out his term, then what should have happened is the vice president, we have to wonder where she was, or the members of the cabinet basically make that step of seeking to have the president, you know, declared incapable of performing his duties and the presidential succession taking over. Now, the problem is that there's no formal legal obligation for the cabinet to do so. It's a permissive language in the 25th Amendment. So what they should have done is different than what they are legally obligated to do. I think that is something that needs to change. And I think that if Congress ever stops dealing with the budget because they resolve it, they need to address this. There need to be hearings. There needs to be an investigation as to who knew what and when and outlining what steps should be taken in future administrations to prevent this from happening again. Because this is not, unfortunately, I don't think this is a unique story in American history. I think that this is something that is also likely to happen again. So leaving aside that these people are, they bear great shame and personal responsibility, and basically they were derelict in their duty. They were derelict in their moral duty, not necessarily their legal one. We need an investigation and we need clarity before we can start making laws or changing the process.
I think that's a really important distinction in terms of the moral responsibility differentiated with a necessarily legal one. And likely the framers of the 25th Amendment presumed, and it was implicit in that, that a cabinet would act on that if there was sufficient reason to do so. But it is voluntary in a sense, in terms of the language. There's not necessarily a compulsion or some sort of penalty for not invoking it when an arbiter suggests that they should have, you know, some of those types of things. So so where should this investigation go? And not just in light of, you know, this book, which obviously could be more politically driven and some of those things, but based on, you know, the Hur report that came out, you know, well before the 2024 primaries, that that found as a matter of the DOJ's investigation, that listeners will recall, that Biden wasn't competent to stand trial for some of the classified documents still in his possession. I mean, just all of these things that show to Congress that there really was an issue here. What should happen in terms of moving forward and ensuring that this type of incompetency never again happens for the executive?
Well, I think in part that the first thing that's needed is a clear-cut investigation. I think that what we would want to call for is a commission made up of both members of the House and the Senate to actually investigate this, to call witnesses, to look at documents, to speak to her and his investigators, for example, to speak to the secretaries in Tapper's book, to see who knew what and when. And there, I mean, look, you can make political hay out of this and you can cast all the blame you want, but you can also look at this as a much needed closing bell, if you will, on a very tragic moment in our history when we had a president who probably would have not been able to carry out his duties should there have been an attack on the U.S. or another major catastrophe. So it's not just seeing who was in charge or what actions they took. It's not just limited to seeing if there was any criminal behavior by people who had a self-interest in acting on Biden's behalf. That's also something to look at. But more generally, what could be done in the future to streamline a process so that we are, the American people, are confident that their president is competent?
Yeah, and in just the last minute or so I have with you, Gerard Folletti, so just quickly, with this investigation, is it possible, do you think, that the pardons that Biden issued, if he is found to be incompetent, can be voided?
I don't think they can, because competency, look, you need a determination of when that happened. And no doctor is going to look in the past and say this is the moment when he was no longer competent. Anything past that point is void. So I don't think that we will have a pardon overturned. But I do think that this is why we need to have this investigation and inquiry, so that we don't have these questions in the future.
Yeah, well, all of this is so important as a matter of law and the Constitution. And Gerard Folletti, really appreciate your commentary today. And again, the Supreme Court arguments on these important issues are happening at 10 a.m. this morning. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And don't forget to tune in tomorrow, each and every Friday, to On Demand, our AFR exclusive podcast, where we do a deeper dive into issues and topics that you care about with guests that you'd like to hear from. So you can also email me, Jenna@AFR.net, to suggest those topics. And so even though I had been out 2 weeks previously, we are back at the podcast starting tomorrow. So definitely tune in at AFR.net. Click the icon or the link for podcasts, and you can find On Demand.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.